business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. These mornings, gonna wake up crazy, gonna grab my gun, kill my baby. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. Some these morning, gonna wake up boozy, gonna grab my gun, gonna kill old Susan. Nobody's business but mine. Going back to Princey Cola, gonna buy my baby money molder. Nobody's business but my own. Hey, babe, did you get that letter or you take me back? I'll treat you better. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. Ain't nobody's dirty business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. From this morning, gonna wake up crazy, gonna grab my gun, gonna kill my baby. Nobody's business but mine. Ain't nobody's doggone business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own. Nobody's dirty business how my baby treat me. Nobody's business but my own.
That kind of gives us an old-timey feeling to start the show with. This is the Inkstuds Radio Hour of Fun. The radio show about comics. We are on CITR 101.9 FM. I am joined this week by my co-host Colin and my guest co-host Luke Mead.
Hello.
Hi.
I can't hear myself at all.
Luke can't hear himself. And Mr. Ivan Brunetti, do we have you there, Ivan?
Yes, I'm here.
Ivan is the creator of Hee Haw Schizo and the all-new anthology of graphic fiction cartoons and true stories from Yale Press. So we've got you on here to yak about the compendium of goodness that you've put out, or put together.
Oh, thanks. When you recited the list of things I've worked on, it was sort of comical. You know,
no pun intended.
I know. It's just kind of sad to think of my life that way. Hee-haw, schizo, and then an anthology of graphic fiction, cartoons, and true stories. So.
Well, it's all great stuff, and it's a really neat collection, because I'm kind of skeptical being a long-term, not long-term, but a in-depth comic reader, and reading so many different comics, like, oh, another anthology, oh boy, yay, stuff that other people should read, but I've read. And I went through it, and it's a really neat collection of stuff. Like, I don't have any of the Mark Newgard Nancy stuff, the Art Spiegelman Peanut stuff, and it's quite a neat collection that you put together.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I guess it's geared more for people that might not be familiar with most of it, with, you know, most of those comics. So it's not really, I guess, meant for the diehard comics fans. But even if you are one of those people, like you or me, I thought it'd just be nice to have all of that stuff together. And then, you know, if you wanted to introduce somebody to this world of comics, it would sort of, even if you just wanted to have a handy book that had a lot of, what I think are the highlights of the medium, especially of, like, mostly the last 20 years, you know, it's all kind of together in one handy compendium.
I wanted to ask you, Ivan, how did you decide when to cut off? Like, you're giving snippets of a lot of, like, really intense graphic novels and stuff like that. What made you decide when to say when, and what made you choose what you put in the book? Because it seems really fluid, and it doesn't it doesn't feel like a ripoff at all in terms of like you're not giving, you know, just like a couple of pages. You're actually showing what the stories represent. And
well, that was the great challenge of the of putting together that book. I guess I'll try to explain it. I mean, I had a lot of things to balance. I mean, number one was you wanted to pick something sort of representative of that person's work. You also wanted to give people kind of a commensurate number of pages. You know, like, I mean, a new person having, say, more pages than Robert Crumb wouldn't really make sense. You're trying to give a sense of, you know, hierarchy to some of the artists, you know, depending on their body of work. At the same time, if you're going to, there wasn't room, obviously, to put an entire graphic novel in there. I mean, you just want to give people a taste of what that person's work is about. So I had to go through and, from the stories that I liked, kind of chose not only a representative excerpt, but something that could kind of work on its own that had an arc, you know, like a beginning, middle, and end, that would at least have you interested in the story and maybe wanting to read the rest of the story. And some of the excerpts I chose specifically because there was maybe something formally innovative within that excerpt, or it was just like a favorite moment in that story. You know, there were just a number of things to balance for me, but it was very difficult to choose the excerpts, and then putting them together next to each other was the other major challenge.
Well, the Chris Ware piece. You took a segment of Jimmy Corrigan, it's a great part that you pulled out. But it's interesting because he's someone who's very cautious about his stuff being not formatted right. So how is something like that going with the challenge of doing a different layout?
That was a
layout?
Challenge, actually. Luckily, I know Chris, and I had some idea of which stories I wanted to use and which excerpt I wanted to use, and he had some input in that where when I first contacted people, if they had any objections to what I chose, they usually let me know, like, I'd rather that you run this, or I'd rather, you know, I mean, I had to balance that a little bit with some of the artists. I mean, it's not one thing when I notice people commenting on this, there's a sort of assumption that that I was a sort of god, and like whatever I wanted to put in the book, I was able to snap my fingers and get it. It's not quite that simple. Some things you kind of have to work with the artist. They don't necessarily want to give you, you know, X number of pages to excerpt or those specific pages. A lot of the artists had input on what they would like to put in there to represent them, and you know, we had we made some compromises, and also a lot of things are just not really available. I mean, some things would have just been prohibitively expensive to put in there, and then there would have been no money left over for the other contributors, because there was a, you know, a limit to the permissions budget as well. So it's not as if anything I picked automatically could make it in there. I mean, there was one artist that I really wanted a different story in there, and I mean, I won't say who it is, but you know, that person had many reasons where they just did not want to reprint that story. And what could I do? I had to choose a different story that I like just as much, and it works in the book. But you know, it wasn't as if it was 1, 2, 3. I can have anything I want from anybody out there. So there were a lot of things to balance putting it together. And with Chris Ware's section, actually, we had a couple of different ways of doing it. At first, I was going to print those Jimmy Corrigan pages very small, sort of two stacked up on two up per page. And then, you know, the Yale production department thought that was just way too small, although Chris didn't think so. But the book kind of actually shrunk in trim size from my original proposal to when it got printed, because it was a little bit too big. So, they, you know, it went down, I think, about a half an inch in height, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it actually, you know, could mean like 10% of the art. The art could be reduced by an additional 10%, which actually is significant, especially when you're looking at tiny lettering.
What's it that Art Spiegelman says? He has two pair of glasses, his regular pair and his Chris Ware pair of glasses.
Right, right. So we ended up actually having to, at kind of like toward the end of the production process, put the Jimmy Corrigan pages just sort of like one page per, you know, just sideways, kind of broadside. And, you know, it was hard to fit everything in there. So there are some of the art was meant to be seen really, really large. And, you know, I tried to do the best I could. There was a limitation to the trim size of the book, and I tried to fit what I could in there, and I'm sure it's debatable, and some people would have preferred some things larger and some things smaller, but as I said, like when you're putting something like this together, there are, you know, many different things to balance, and there's compromises here and there to just kind of try to fit everything in there. And it was very important for me to have a huge number of artists in there. I didn't, you know, I could have done a book that had 12 people in it, but I wanted to give the readers like a just kind of an overwhelming sense of how much kind of stuff is out there. And it's not as if the book is comprehensive. I state that in the introduction, you know, that I would have loved to had 50 more artists in there, and I wasn't exaggerating. I could have put 50 more artists that I really love in there, and it was difficult not to put certain things in there, but I had a certain limit to the pages, so, you know, the book was already over the page count specified in the contract as it was, so I had to beg for those extra pages, and we made a compromise of how much extra they would go.
And that's something neat, is like how you try and do good sampling stuff, so you have stuff here like a Gasoline Alley page and a Crazy Cat page. How would you decide like what page to really represent what this is? Because Crazy Cat, like, I mean, you could take 20 different pages and they're all completely different.
Sure. I mean, with that one, it was looking through people's collections of kind of what they had clipped. I wanted something with those old Sundays, and I would have loved to have put more old Sundays in there. Sort of, I wanted to scan it directly from the printed source, and I wanted to see the newspaper. So I actually went, I mean, I had a few of those pages, and Chris Ware had some. You'll note that several of those Sunday pages were from his collection, so we kind of went through and picked, picked some that I thought worked well in the issue, where there was some formal experimentation, or where he kind of treated the canvas of the Sunday page in this kind of theatrical way, or had a sense of architecture to it. So that particular one I chose, just I thought worked well next to the Ron Rigi excerpt, just because he was thinking of the page as an architectural structure, and I wanted to see Ron's pages next to Crazy Cat. I just thought it'd be interesting to put those together, even though, you know, they're 60 years apart. There was just something, I like the idea of putting things like that seem very different next to each other, because then you can kind of see that there is a connection in those things, which was that the artist was looking at the page as a unit.
That's a great juxtaposition, and like the piece used by Kevin Izenga is also quite like that, where it's one of his more experimental pieces.
Right, and I'm sure some people would think, like, why'd you choose that excerpt? He's done so much stuff.
Yeah, it's such a clean drawing style.
But that particular one, I wanted a sense in the book that some of these things were meant to be seen as different books, or they were produced as small books. Like there's the there's a mini comic in there by Jonathan Bennett where I wanted to show that little booklet. And same with Kevin's stuff, where that particular story, I mean, part of it was the experience of it that was, you know, folding out that page, and it was almost like a metaphor for the character kind of experiencing a sort of epiphany or enlightenment in some way, where his brain expanded. And, you know, to get that full sense, you want to show that you were supposed to flip these pages and then open it up into this huge fold out, and it was kind of like your mind opening up. So I tried to retain that. Obviously, ideally you would have his small book and be able to do that with the page, but it was just kind of like a way to simulate that same experience.
Oh, it's all excellent stuff, and I love the range. One thing I was wondering about, and peep in if you guys got any questions too, is when you're putting the book together, you have a lot of new stuff like Jonathan Bennett, and which I was very happy to see that strip, because I just recently got into his stuff through MoM. And it's like, oh, a mini comic I'll never be able to find. So it's nice to see it printed here. Is how you're going through it, and were you trying to like come up with a balance, because you got all this great new stuff. You got all these new guys like Jonathan Bennett, Kevin Izenga, and Sammy Harkham, trying to balance that. And then like, if you kind of like find some old stuff that is equally great, just kind of falling to the wayside?
I guess you're making compromises on some level. I did want to have, I mean, I guess I'll talk about like when Yale first contacted me, how they envisioned the book. It was meant to be kind of, I mean, it was definitely inspired by McSweeney's, edited by Chris Ware, that issue, the number 13 issue, that was all comics. We know they wanted to make a nice art book that kind of focused on the high points of these more literary comics. That was a something they definitely wanted. And, you know, they definitely wanted to have an excerpt of Mouse. And I have to say also, like, you can't just take a whole chapter of Mouse. I mean, the publisher doesn't just let you do that. There was, I think they'd made an exception because the author let them or talked them into it for the Smithsonian book where they actually excerpted a whole chapter, but that's very rare. So, you know, I had to choose something that was not an entire chapter, so I picked something that where there was actually a structure to it, and you were supposed to compare the first page to the last page. You know, there was actually a subtle thing that Art Spiegelman did from that first page of the excerpt to that last page of the excerpt. But anyway, I'm getting far afield. I actually forgot the original question because I'm talking too much. This is the way my brain works. I'm sorry to go off on tangent. You have to, like, rephrase your question or restate your question.
I guess what I was wondering about is when you're selecting the material, did you find yourself...
there's new and old.
Yeah, right? Do you find yourself drawn to the newer stuff and kind of forgetting about some of the older stuff?
Okay. I remember what I was trying to say. Well, the bulk of the book was always meant to be stuff from about the last 20 years or so. So that was definitely meant to be the bulk of it. And then... sort of like the high points. So it's hard to pick something that's brand new because you don't really know in 5 years if it's how you're going to feel about that piece or that artist, or you know what I mean? It's kind of hard to know where they're going to go or how that really fits into their work, like life's work. It's a lot easier for some of the artists that have been doing a lot more work for a lot longer time, and you can kind of place their work in certain categories or certain periods, and then you can pick something out. So I always figured that maybe 10% of the book, or 10 or 15%, would be much older stuff, and that maybe 10 or 15% would be brand new stuff where, you know, definitely, like, these are young artists, and they're probably going to do much more important work in the future. But you want to give a sense of some of these new artists being, I think, in the kind of influenced by, you know, the artists that have been doing it for the last 20, 30 years as well. So I just wanted to show everything kind of as a continuity, but, you know, definitely the bulk of the book was always meant to be things mostly like from the period of Mouse and, you know, the early part of Raw and Weirdo, let's say, like, you know, in like 1980 till about, like, you know, 2000, roughly, you know, like that 20-year period. That was always meant to be kind of the bulk of the book, and then I wanted to round it off with some much older stuff and maybe tangential material. And, you know, have a few new artists in there just to kind of give a sense that it's not like a dead art form. There's new people that are still continuing.
And it's neat. It shows change and growth in the art form, too.
You know, the thing is, like, Kevin Huizing has done some great stories even since that mini-comic, and it would have been great to put, you know, one of his 20-page excerpts in there. But then I also felt that would feel kind of wrong to give somebody new 20 pages and then somebody that's, you know, done a lot more work 5 pages. What I mean is, this sort of, there was just a lot of things to balance and consider when you, you know, put these things next to each other. At the same time, I really did want to have something like, you know, you have a 3-page story by Lauren Weinstein, who's a relatively new cartoonist, and it's pretty close to, you know, 30 pages of Robert Crumb. There might be like one story in between there, but I also didn't want it to feel off balance where, you know, you can go from a 3-page story by a new cartoonist to a 30-page section and a much more established cartoonist, and it wouldn't feel lopsided. I really felt that each little, even if it was a short excerpt, like, everything should really stand up to everything else in the book.
I think Colin has a question.
I don't actually own the book myself, but I was looking through it, and I didn't see anything in the way of Japanese or European artists. Was that a deliberate decision, or or something that doesn't interest you, or did you just not have the space?
No, it interests me. In the introduction, I actually addressed that briefly. Basically, it's just sort of like for brevity's sake. You know, I knew that I had a page count, a limited page count, and if I included the whole world, this book would have easily doubled in size. So I thought, kind of taking a cue from McSweeney's again, just kind of limiting it to North America, just and like stuff that wouldn't have to be translated. Just kind of actually could you hold on 1 second, please? You might want to
put
that other item for 1 second. Yeah, hold on.
I'll play a song now.
Okay,
if you want to take a break. Okay,
thank you.
This is NutriMilk Hotel. We'll be back with Mr. Brunetti.
Huh?
Perfect. You know, like as far as the length of it and stuff and where you landed, it was exactly perfect.
And the first one tore a picture of a dead and hanging man who was kissing foreign fishes that flew right out from his hand. And when I put my arms around it, felt the blushing blood run through my cheeks and an airiness around it. When his tongue began to speak and he said, oh boy, you are so pretty. And after I tied in Wright's paper string, and when I finally kissed him, the whole world began to ring. Lost like a bell that's tipping over, with two cracks along both sides. And I knew the world was over, so I took a look outside and watched the fires that were reaching up to the weather vane and the tops of trees and the waiting scene in the Sunday dream. They're all waiting here for me. Deli markets with their flower stands and pretty girls in that burning mist hanging out on the hooks next to the window display. And I took out my tongue twice removed from my face, across the bridge and across the mountains, through a nickel in a fountain. Save my soul from all these troubled times and all the drugs that I don't have the guts to take to choose my mind. I'm always sober, always aching, always heading toward mass suicide. I call figurines and waste the gas station attendants attending to their job. And a nice drive in the country finds a nice cliff to drop off. Oh, and this life just gets so great, all the prettiness of life. But don't take those pills your boyfriend gave you, you're too wonderful to die. Picture from the pornographic page, when all the pleasure points attacking, all the looks of love were staged. And it's a lie that you've been given that just hurts you every day. So why should I lay here naked when it's just too far away from anything we could call love, any love worth living for? So I'll sleep out in the gutter, you can sleep here all. And when I wake up in the morning, I forget to lock the door. Cause with a match that's mean and some gasoline, you won't see me anymore.
Wow, what a great song.
That was fabulous. Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. We are joined by Ivan.
Sorry about that. I'm actually, this is, maybe you'll find this funny, I'm actually at my job, and we have open cubicles now. I don't have an office. So my boss just happened to, there was something going on, and stopped by my cubicle because there's no door now that I can close.
Well, that's interesting.
I'm sorry about that.
Ivan, I wanted to ask you about that in schizo number three.
It's a different job.
It's a different job? It is a different job? Okay.
A different job, different office, different university I'm working for.
I wanted to know, though, did any of your coworkers happen to read it?
Yes, I changed all the names and stuff.
How'd that go over, though?
Not well. I remember at a party, actually, one of the young women that worked at that particular job happened to be at this party.
One of the cute girls?
Sort of pointed her finger at me and got really angry and, you know, chastised me.
My God.
The thing is, the bad thing was that the character she thought was her was actually not her. It was only partially her. It was a combination of two people. So she was kind of flattering herself, but I didn't say that.
Oh,
man. For the listeners, by the way, schizo number three is Mr. Brunetti's slice of life at a day in the life at work. And it's a brilliant office piece of office humor kind of thing.
It's out of almost out of print now, and in the spring there's going to be a collection of all my old issues from Fantagraphics. So
the Misery Loves Comedy,
right? So all those old issues will be collected into one volume.
Now I know it's kind of a different, it's almost like a different Ivan that did Schizo 1-3 that then number 4. Is that a good way of saying it?
I guess. I mean, you know, we all grow, supposedly. I mean, hopefully, we all kind of evolve slightly. So, I'm definitely not as angry as I used to be. So, maybe I've mellowed out somewhat. I don't know. But part of it is, I mean, there was definitely an energy to the older stuff. But it was, I don't think they were as good a comics, but they do have something because of that kind of unchecked energy. And, you know, I've been working in a slightly different way just because I haven't had as much time to draw, so I'm kind of spending longer and longer on each page now, so you know, you have more and more time to reflect on what you're doing. I mean, I think of myself as being the same person through that whole time, but I definitely had peaks and valleys.
Did the response to Schizo number 1 take you aback at all? Because the letters page of Schizo number 2 is, you've got an anthology of basically the people on top of their game. Like, you got the best artists in the world writing you and complimenting you and everything like that. Did that take you by surprise at all?
Oh, definitely it did. Well, the thing is, just for the sake of disclosing this, I sent my issue out to a lot of those people. Not every one of those that was writing me, but a lot of those were my favorite artists, and I actually sent them the issue. Just, I don't know what, I wouldn't do that now. But at the time, I just wanted to, I guess, show it to people. I don't know. Something came over me, and I just told them, like, you're one of my favorite artists, and wanted to give you my comic book. And much to my surprise now, I mean, now I can see how amazing this is, that, you know, most of those people wrote back, almost all of them wrote back, and knowing how busy most artists are and how many things like that they get in the mail, and now being on the other side of that, where people send me stuff, kind of going full circle here, I know it's difficult to find the time to get back to everybody. So I was really flattered that people took the time to respond and give me, you know, I asked for their feedback for a lot of them, and they, you know, they did give me their comments, and I'm really appreciative that so many of them took the time to do that. But yeah, it totally floored me. I wasn't expecting it. I mean, like, when I had a letter from Robert Crumb in the mail, my heart almost jumped out of my throat. Basically, I was afraid to open it. I was so nervous. And he actually wrote a very nice letter. So
I think he recommended Prozac, didn't he?
He did, and I ended up trying Prozac, but that actually made my, many years later, but it made my life much worse. So
Prozac. Well, we all remember what happened to Phil Hartman.
Oh, was that Prozac's fault?
It was Prozac and Coke.
It's the Prozac's fault.
And Coke. I have a couple of questions from some local cartoonists. Rebecca Dart, who is a big fan of your work. She had one question is, do you feel more or less creative when you're feeling depressed and antisocial?
I am not more creative. I think I'm more self-absorbed. And in my head, I feel like I'm coming up with ideas, but I can't actually put them on paper. It's only when I'm not feeling that depressed that I can go in front of the table and start to make something. I might write some, you know, I might scribble some things in my notebook, but it's really hard to actually get any work done. So it might inspire you to be creative later if you get past things like that. I mean, you remember what those feelings are like. But I think when you're in the middle of it, it's very very hard to actually produce anything. Actually, Rebecca Dart was one of the very first people that wrote to me. They put out Schizo Number One, I remember, her letter.
She's a talented lady. I highly recommend reading Rabbit Head if you haven't.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that she's in the Best American Comics.
Yeah, right in between your piece and Chris Ware's piece.
Uh-huh.
So
that's a good sandwich.
That's it. That is. That kind of brings me over to...
I'm not even going
to... Yeah, no, I stayed off that one.
All right.
Oh, yeah, listener discretion be advised if we talk about some of the gag strips.
Yes, there's going to be some language coming up here, folks.
So. We don't have the FCC up here, so don't worry about cussing. I just
not
did the...
Not so much as... I met her husband, isn't it?
Yep.
Another Robin.
He was my traveling companion on my our voyage.
I'm not going to be referring to another man's wife as part of a sandwich. It's just my personal code of ethics.
Oh, I don't think he'd mind. He's an odd duck. Part of the talking about the creative drive, I noticed that in the latest issue of Schizo, you have the 4-page thing of the August 2001 to July 2002.
Right.
Is that one of those strips where you just felt like that's as far as you could go with it?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a small history to that. I was supposed to do a year-end comic for the Chicago Reader, the weekly paper here. And so the thing is, I dealt with this editor that wanted to see sketches and all that stuff. And I tend to work, you know, on the page, and I make a lot of changes when I'm drawing. I don't like sending a script or anything. So that was kind of a different way of working for me, where I had to type up the dialogue and stuff. I don't normally do that, but she wanted to see all the text of the strip as if it was separate from the drawings or something. And it went through all these go-arounds with this editor, and in the end, they didn't want to run the strip, so I ended up never finishing it. But I had those notes, and I was going to draw it anyway. But then when I was looking through those, I thought, I don't even know if there's any point doing that.
You felt like the story had been told.
Yeah, kind of. You saw where my mind was, in a way, just from the drawings and from the notes. And I thought they were just kind of interesting on their own. It almost would have ruined it to actually finish it. To me, I felt like it just should end there.
And actually, I quite appreciate that. I do think that's one of the more interesting. I really get into when artists go into like the process. That's one thing about the show is we do try and talk about process of how sometimes people will work on a strip, and cartooning will destroy you. Another kind of, I guess, unfinished page from that book.
Yeah, it's interesting because the period that the one with the 4 pages, that period that I'm depicting, I drew it later. I probably drew it. Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, it's really strange. I mean, like, I can't get the times exactly right, but, like, part of what I was depicting in the one where you saw the 4 pages is actually the same time period where I was drawing. At that same time, I was drawing that strip that became the Cartooning Will Destroy You strip. So, like, it was just a really bad period for me. And I remember having that strip, Cartooning Will Destroy You, on my drawing table for about 4 months. I mean, like, I was on my table for like 2.5 months, and then September 11th happened, and then I didn't draw anything for another month and a half after that. I remember that period. And then when I did that other strip later, it was sort of about that same time period, and again, I couldn't actually bring myself to finish that strip either, so it was just like a really dark time.
Speaking of process, then, Ivan, I wanted to ask you about your 4-panel comics. Now, disclaimer, you're going to hear some foul language here, but your titles have always amazed me. And, like, for example, I'm looking right here. We have all of your work here in front of us. Gruff but Kindly Old Ass Huffer. And Dimwitted Genetic Atrocity with a Huge Heart On.
Killing me, stop.
Okay. And do the titles come first, or do you do the panels?
Oh, that was so long ago, I don't even remember. I mean, it probably varied from strip to strip. I think I would just start drawing whatever. This is like, at the time that I was coming up with those, I was working that old job that is depicted in Schizo Number 3. And, you know, in between, when I'm in my lunch hour or on my break or whatever, I would just have all these foul things going through my head, and I'd put them on paper. And sometimes like I'd have a title and I'd start drawing that. Other times I'd have a strip and then I'd, you know, just do a little sequence and then I'd come up with a title after. So it kind of varied from, you know, I can't remember exactly. I wish I'd kept my notes from that time. I would have had a better sense of what was going through my head exactly.
Were the outrageous strips kind of cathartic in a way?
Yeah, they were always the first strips that I did with every issue because, it was sort of like my natural inclination to do these sort of gag strips. And I would start with those, and then I guess I'd dance around some of the issues that were going through my head with those strips, and then they would sort of be a warm-up to taking that same whatever was going through my mind, you know, and taking that stuff and actually turning it into a more personal story that was more directly autobiographical. But I found that it was really hard to jump into the autobiography without, like, letting off steam or having that cathartic experience of doing these sort of short strips.
Well, that's something is one of our local booksellers, Chris Brayshaw, owns Pulp Fiction Books, the best used bookstore in Vancouver. But plug free advertising. He also sometimes writes for or used to write for the Comics Journal.
Right, I remember his name.
He said that he wanted me to make sure to say that he found number three. He was working in the library when that came out, and he just found it just such a great coping thing for him. Like someone else feels the same way. And do you find that a reaction a lot? It's like you kind of like...
Yeah, I do. It's kind of odd because it wasn't that horrible a job. I mean, it's like it was, you know, an office job. It wasn't like I was digging ditches or, you know, shoveling human feces or something like that. I mean, it was, as far as jobs go, I mean, certainly you could have way worse jobs than working in an office. At the same time, like, I felt like I was wasting my life, you know, so I was depressed. But I think a lot of people are in that kind of situation where, you know, you thought your life would end up somewhere very different than where you are, but I don't want to give the impression, like, that's certainly not the worst job I've ever had. So, but there were just a lot of weird people because it was a university press, and they tend to attract sort of a particular type of personality and, you know, a lot of eccentric people, and I guess I probably in some ways fit in with that. I just thought it was kind of an interesting place. So it was, you know, there were definitely a few axes to grind in there, certainly. But I think a lot of people are in a similar boat. So I did find that people relate to it, which is kind of strange because it was such a specific story about such a specific place, and yet I get that all the time that people related to it. So.
I always find it odd when you think about the workplaces. You spend most of your time with this group of people that you have absolutely nothing in common with. Spend more time with the people in your workplace than you do with anyone else in your life. And it's
right.
Just,
it's like high school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like you just get thrown in. It's not as bad as high school because they sort of have something in common with you in some ways. But, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it is like somebody just threw you into some experimental labyrinth or something. They're just going to watch how these little rats interact or something.
Someone ends up gnawing on their own ankle because they're
sure.
Lost. Some musical choices. I don't know if I mentioned the music we played. We started out with Mississippi John Hurt. The name of the song, where did I write it down? Nobody's Business But My Own. And I played Nutrimilk Hotel, A Song Against Sex. Why the choices in music? I'm always curious.
Choices? I like a lot of music. That's just a very, I just picked four things that day when you asked me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you sound good.
And it was quite an eclectic mix.
Those are some of my favorite songs. But there's so many favorite songs. I listen to a lot of different stuff. So.
Well, I think Nutrimilk Hotel kind of stood out for me because his story is very similar to in Schizo Number 4, where you have all your biographies of people, all these like really talented, creative people. And he's kind of similar in that way where he did this like incredible album, I guess, about 8 years ago and then just kind of disappeared.
Yeah, you know... And I'm going to give away something I'm working on, but I actually was going to do a biographical comic about Jeff Mangum.
Wow.
So maybe next year. I'm going to try to do it next year when I have a little more time. I've started doing a lot of research on it, and luckily he's reclusive enough that there's not a ton of interviews and stuff. But mm-hmm. That's kind of, and there was that book that came out recently that was the story of that album, of Aeroplane Over the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea that he's not in the book. Didn't want to be interviewed, and it's all these people talking about him, and he's sort of a ghostly presence. I want to sort of capture a little bit of that feeling in the strip that I'm doing as well. So But yeah, I've been wanting to do a strip about him. So
he's quite interesting. I mean, his whole... I guess I won't get into too much because, like, you know, people should check it out. But, I mean, that album pretty much destroyed him.
Because
it was just all about... well, listen to the album, people.
Yeah, no, it's very... I think it's one of the best things to come out of, you know, what you might roughly call pop music.
Mm-hmm. I'll concur. I think on that note, I'll... should we keep going? I think we'll just keep going.
Sure.
We'll just keep going. I don't think I'll be able to play the Bach. We'll probably
fine.
Just...
Yes, probably that would bore your listeners. They're used to, when we first went on, I heard that, you know, the very energetic rock music just sort of desexualized.
Yeah, the...
But that Bach piece is actually maybe my all-time favorite piece of music.
So. It was quite nice. It was by... I found the version you're asking for.
Pablo Casals. Yeah. He's sort of the guy that rescued that from complete obscurity when he was a... very young, he found this manuscript of those pieces, which had kind of been completely forgotten about, probably for centuries, and they were thought of as sort of just technical exercises, and he spent years and years and years kind of playing them and kind of discovered the this inherent emotional power in those pieces. They weren't just technical exercises. There's a similar story with Glenn Gould with some other Bach pieces, the Goldberg Variations, where again, they were kind of thought to be in the Wohltemperte Klavier is another one, where they were just kind of written off as these technical exercises, but they're actually kind of very powerful pieces if you start to explore them, but they were just sort of forgotten about for so long. I wanted to do a strip about these things as well. So
history seems like it's a really important thing for you in your process.
What is important?
History.
History?
Yeah, just like learning like just what goes into things.
I guess, yeah. I mean, with those particular things, they're sort of related to my overall aesthetic, I guess, with comics, too. I've been working toward simplifying my drawing to the point where it's almost mathematical, and I think maybe I'm attracted to that music that seems like it's technical and mathematical and has, like, this geometry and architecture to it, but that if you actually immerse yourself in it, you start to almost like you tap into this emotional... reserve that's kind of hidden under the surface, and maybe I'm attracted to that kind of music because I'm aiming for that with my own work, although I'm falling obviously far short of Bach, but the same kind of idea where I want it on the surface to seem one way, but I want people to explore it, and I don't expect people to explore it, but I like the idea of somebody discovering this thing that maybe would be dismissed. And
is that part... So I'll let you finish.
No, just finding that there's other layers to things sometimes.
And is that part of, with the book, the latest Schizo, is you have all the biographies of these obscure people.
Here's a funny thing. I don't think of any of those people as obscure, I guess, because, like, in my mind, they loom much larger, I guess, than in most people's minds.
Well, Colin and I did a show where we talked about this issue. We'd spent a whole hour talking about this issue and a couple other skits, the earlier Schizos, and we're like, who are these people? And we had people calling into the show like, you don't know who this is. So I guess what obscure is to one person is not to another. So
maybe Val Lewton, the filmmaker, is a little bit obscure if you're not into movies. Kierkegaard is certainly one of the most famous philosophers. Eric Satie, I mean, if you listen to classical music radio, they're going to play Eric Satie. And his music is used very often in films. I thought of those people as being pretty famous. I mean, maybe Francoise Hardy is kind of an acquired taste. Or I thought Louise Brooks was, I mean...
Louise Brooks, we knew.
Everyone knew who that is.
So,
I forget which other ones I did, but Mondrian is pretty famous too, I guess. So, I don't know, I thought of all those people as being famous, but not the people that you would consider the greatest in their field. But I guess in my personal pantheon, they kind of are for one reason or another. Maybe not always for the reason they would have liked.
It seems more like a reason of character than a reason of talent in some of these people.
I don't know if that's totally true. I mean, I like some of them because I think with Mondrian, I actually do find a lot of his work moving, which is, again, there's this idea of like things having this mathematical structure, but that might seem cold and technical, but I think they're not. But he was basically a mystic. I mean, the more I explored his life, he was. I find out all this stuff that you just wouldn't associate with from what you see from the paintings. And I also think a lot of, you know, maybe he was a little bit crazy, but I also think of most artists as being crazy, and maybe myself included. So I was attracted to like having a certain view of your artwork that is not how people interpret it. So maybe that was part of what attracted me to writing about him. But I don't know. I mean, in a way, like I don't really know until I draw the strip what it's all about. And sometimes it takes years to see how these things fit together. Like for a long time, I didn't even realize that I was. I think just about every single one of those biographies in that book, except for the last one, the Val Lewton one, all those people were hermits. Like they all became hermits, and I didn't even notice that until I'd done all these strips about hermits. That I, you know, like, gee, all my biographies are about people that became hermits. You know, it didn't even occur to me. I guess it was just sort of this thing I noticed later. That, you know, it had a lot to do with my own life because I was becoming more and more of a hermit for a long time. So it's kind of interesting that at the end of the book, I start, you know, the last biography I do is somebody that didn't become a hermit. Maybe that was kind of an indication to me that I'm moving away from that myself.
Spreading out and putting out some new stuff. Different stuff. I have a question from Mr. Robin Bougie. He is wondering, is self-censorship an issue for you? How much do you feel comfortable sharing about yourself through your work?
I'll share just about anything, I guess, but some things, I don't know if they're interesting to people. You know, it's actually an interesting question because in my next issue, I wanted to write about this particular crazy period of my life a few years ago where I, you know, after a lifetime of not having much luck with women, all of a sudden I had like 2 or 3 years of a lot of women in my life, and it was kind of strange, and I made a lot of bad choices during that time. And but it's really difficult for me to write about that because there's other people involved, and you know, you have to turn it into something fictional, and you don't know how much to fictionalize because you might get to the point where you lose the power of the truth of the story if you change it too much. So it's been, I don't mind sharing things about myself, but when there's other, I wouldn't say I'm fearless in that regard. I think David Heatley is the most fearless cartoonist in that regard, but I'm willing to go pretty deep as far as showing things about myself. But when you have other people that are based on real people in your life, you kind of have to respect their privacy. So it gets, that's the part that becomes difficult for me. I tend to censor that more than I would censor what would go through my own mind in depicting that.
I think Luke,
is there is, but is there ever a limit to what people would view as bad taste?
Yeah, actually, you know, the other weird thing is I'm kind of I'm kind of prudish in many ways. So, like a lot of what I draw, I think I'm leaving a lot to the reader's imagination, and this is maybe my own misinterpretation of my own work. But it's kind of interesting that a few years ago, after I did that book, Haw. This guy decided to make a sketchbook where he took it to a comic convention, and he had the artist at that convention redraw one of the panels from that gag book.
Well, we're looking at it right now, as a matter of fact. So which can I ask which one?
Oh, well, I mean, he
was getting
just redraw
of...
whatever one they wanted.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he did a whole little, and then he actually printed up a mini comic of a lot of those. And the funny thing was that the way people remembered the strips was much more graphic and filthy than what I had actually drawn.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, my theory is that the perversity is really, like, in the reader's mind, and it just sort of taps into things in there. But it was just kind of humorous to me that people were much more graphic than I actually was.
Have you been accused of misogyny or anything like that by certain groups or anything?
Yes.
Okay.
Many times.
Enough said.
I've certainly gone through periods where maybe that was true, because I would say, like, oh yeah, maybe you have a point there, mm-hmm. you know. But I don't know. I think I've made some progress since then.
Have you ever been accused of, you know, just faking it?
Of faking it?
Well, doing things to shock for shock's sake.
I think not directly to my face, but I had read things like that in the past. Which I mean, if people want to think that, that's fine. But I. That has never been one of my goals. I actually try, like, not to be shocking in some ways. I mean, that's why I present everything sort of with this innocent veneer of, like, very cartoony drawings. They're, like, so unrealistic that you have to use your own brain to kind of fill in the reality. So,
we're coming near the end. We got, I guess, about 4 more minutes. I have a couple questions to do, a couple more books, or a couple questions to do with the anthology book.
Uh-huh.
One is there a plan to follow up with another one? Because, like I said, there is so much that wasn't able to be included.
That's a good question, too. It's like you read my mind or something.
Just poking out ideas.
I had it in the back of my head that, like, it would be so, you know, it would be nice to actually take the stuff I couldn't put in there, and there's, you know, new stuff all the time that I'm seeing that I wish I could have put in there, and maybe, you know, I'm thinking of proposing a volume to Yale, and they're actually interested in the idea. I don't want to water down the first volume, like, by immediately having another one, so mm-hmm. I'd like to space it out by a few years, and I'd like to have it a different focus as well. But I could see myself being crazy enough to go through this whole process again at some point. I'm not ready right this minute.
Was it a pretty personally taxing experience to kind of go so in-depth into...
Yeah, there's a lot to do. I mean, I did a lot of the production work, too, and a lot of the scanning and fixing the artwork, and, you know, I had to make sure I got all the artwork from people, and some of it was hard to find. You know, I had to reconstruct it, scan it, and fix up, you know. I mean, there was a lot of restoring to do. I had to do all the permission stuff. I mean, you know, even some of the, like, just the paying of the people. I took a lot of what I had to do. Like, it was more than just choosing the pieces. I had to do a lot of this other work for the book. So it's not just like I'm sitting there in my armchair, like, picking out artists, you know. I mean, that's hard enough in and of itself, because you do have to choose the, like, the perfect excerpt, and that is a lot of time and effort, but... Anyway, yeah, I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it, even though it would be a lot of work. I can envision something in my head that's different enough from this book where they would make nice companions, like a brother and sister.
Mm-hmm. Colin?
I just wanted to say I met you many years ago at SPX, and you were carrying around a sketchbook where you had different artists drawing how you were going to die.
Oh, no, no. You know what it was?
Oh, what was it?
It was I asked people to draw a hateful caricature of me.
Oh,
some
right.
people took it to me, like, oh, I'm going to draw myself killing you. It was actually just supposed to be just do, like, the most hateful caricature of me that you can. It was interesting to see different people interpret my own drawings. And people did whatever they wanted with it. Some people just couldn't actually, they were nice enough that they did not want to draw something hateful.
Well,
they refused, but some people were more than happy.
I just wanted to apologize that I couldn't. I never got around to actually doing one, a drawing.
Oh, well, I'll bring it. I still have that book, you know, but it's strange. Like, nobody really wants to draw in it now. So it's just sort of been sitting. There's still a few pages left in there. Blank pages, so you know, maybe I'll bring it around again to another convention.
Put it on eBay.
I should just donate it to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund or something like
there
that.
There we go. One thing about the book is you start out with a lot of strips, and were strips important to you as developing as a comics fan?
You mean like the daily strips
yeah.
type things? Yeah, I mean, the way the book is structured is it kind of moves from, you know, doodles to kind of one-panel structures, and then toward shorter sequences, which are like daily strips, and then it moves toward full pages and longer stories. So there's sort of a sort of rhythm to the book that you can kind of read it as a continuum. I think Peanuts is one of the greatest strips ever, so I definitely, I mean, in a way, Charles Schulz is kind of hovering over the whole book. I think of Charles Schulz and Robert Crumb as my two favorite cartoonists, like maybe the two biggest influences on me. And I think their influence is kind of evident through that whole book, like how much my tastes were shaped by those two people.
Well, I think we're at the end of our time. I want to thank you, Ivan.
Oh, thank you.
I very much see that if you haven't checked out the work, I mean, your whole love of Peanuts is pretty evident in the latest schizo. How are Linus and Schroeder?
My cats are kind of driving me crazy lately because I have a third cat now because I got married, and they're trying to kill my wife's cat.
Aww. What's its name?
It's like cat warfare in my home right now. trying to deal with that situation. But I still, it's really strange. Like, it's like sort of like having kids, like where you can hate them one moment, but deep down you still love them, even though they're doing these things that make you want to kill them, you know? But,
I'm sorry, you have Linus Schroeder and what now?
The other cat is, her name's Dismay.
Oh.
Dismay?
That was my wife's cat. She's actually a very nice cat. I was like, she's the nicest, most sensitive cat that I've met. So maybe these cats reflect our personalities. My cats are kind of like monsters.
My cat's a little monster, too. I named her Bukowski, so maybe that's one of the problems. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Ivan.
Thank you for having me.
We're all huge fans of your work, and... When will we see another schizo?
I'm going to try to actually finish it by the end of next year, and I want to do another oversized one, full color. So I'm going to put myself on a much stricter schedule, and I'm hoping to get it done, you know, a year from now or maybe a little bit over a year from now. But I have other projects going on at the same time. So.
I know. I feel like we've run out of time because there's so much more I want to ask about. I want to ask about you teach and all sorts of stuff. So maybe
it's like my whole life's just been... I'm really busy, which keeps me from being as depressed as I used to be.
Well, hopefully we can meet up again maybe in the new year for another talk. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And have a pleasant day.
You too.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That was Mr. Ivan Brunetti. This is the Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. I am going to finish off with the Fairy Tale of New York from the Pogues, as was his request. Because, you know, it's an appropriate song. Vancouver is a snowy wasteland. Well, I guess it's not snowy. It's going to become a slushy wasteland. Bah humbug, I say to snow. Bah humbug. CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Crimes and Treasons. What? Yeah. Ink Studs. Yeah.
It was Christmas Eve, babe. Drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then when we sang a song, the rare old mountain tune, I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Years for me and you, so happy Christmas. I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true.
You promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome.
You were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the drunks they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing Galway Bay. And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
Dripping that bed.
You scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy faggot. Happy Christmas, you're all so great. God, it's our love.
The boys of the NYPD choir are still singing Galway Bay. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day. I could have
been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me when I first found you.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
Are ringing out for Christmas Day.